Well, now that you guys can hear me, I'll introduce myself. So for those of you who don't know me, my name is Eric Sears. You may see me around the church because my wife Lydia and I operate as half the church secretary. And so I'm half and she's the other half, which works for marriage as well, I guess, so that's good. Got a few chuckles. That's a good start. But I also happen to work for InterVarsity Christian Fellowship, as David was praying for us earlier this morning. And my wife, Lydia, also works for InterVarsity. And so we're missionaries to the college campus. And so we work with CMU students. And our vision is to see CMU students of all backgrounds come to know Jesus and to follow Jesus with their whole lives. And so what we really do as the staff for InterVarsity is we really try to empower students to reach their friends, reach their classmates, reach whatever groups they're a part of. Because we realize we can't just walk on to the college campus and reach all the nursing students or reach all the athletes or all the Frisbee kids. But we know Christian students who are nurses, who play Frisbee. And so we try to help empower them to reach their friends. And so just a little bit more of a picture of what that looks like. We just finished selecting our leaders for next year. So people have been in our group this year and who will be leading stuff next year. And we have two girls who are going to start nursing groups, one student who's starting a group specifically for engineers. We have one girl who's interested in reaching non-Christian students, and so she's going to start what we call a group investigating God. It's a space entirely for non-Christian students to come and learn more about Jesus. And so it's our job to help them start all of those things, help them lead those things. And help them grow in their own faith through leading those things. And then, of course, many of you have also heard about our coming trip to Mexico, which the church was very kind and donated a portion of the 30 pieces of silver offering to that. And so we'll be spending 6 weeks in Mexico, and we'll be teaching conversational English on the university campus. And then we'll also be partnering with the campus ministry that's on that campus called COMPA. So they do what we do with InterVarsity just in Mexico, except they're not allowed to have religious activities on their college campus. And so we're going to teach English to these university students and then actually be able to invite them to off-campus events for COMPA, for this campus ministry. And so we're hoping to not only help these students with their English, but also get them connected with a place where they can grow in their faith. And of course, the big reason we're doing it is because we're taking students down there to grow in their own leadership and grow in their own faith as well. So that's why Matthew is going and a few other people from around Colorado. So that's a little bit about me. I just wanted to thank the elders for giving me an opportunity to preach. And giving me the opportunity to preach the first four, actually, after now that Pastor Steve's sabbatical has started. So hopefully you like what I have to say because you're stuck with me for at least 3 more weeks after this. So either that or you're going to riot and I'm going to get kicked out. But hopefully I have good things to say. So as I was saying, I work with college students, and one of the main questions that my students often ask me is, what do you do with the Old Testament? The Old Testament's kind of weird, right? There are a bunch of laws. There are people that seem to be good, and then they do really, really stupid things, right? Sometimes even evil or broken things. And often my students ask me, am I really supposed to take these people as examples of faith when they have such great moral failures? And so I often talk to them about how they're only seeing the trees in the forest. They're missing their way through the forest. But the reality is that's actually starting to become true for churches too. And so actually there's a a seminary professor who recently wrote a book called The Old Testament is Dying. It's a very provocative title, but his point is that our congregations in the United States in particular are missing the point of the Old Testament, and so they only know their New Testament. And he would actually argue that if you don't understand the Old Testament, you don't understand Jesus, which becomes pretty important, right? If Jesus is the center of our faith, the Messiah, to not understand him is a pretty big thing. And the example he gives is he points at Jesus' crucifixion. And on the cross, it's recorded in Matthew's gospel that Jesus says, my God, why have you forsaken me? And this seminary professor is teaching a Sunday school class at his church, and they were talking about the crucifixion. And he asked what people thought about that phrase that Jesus says. And people had all sorts of answers, all sorts of theological answers, all sorts of insights that they had gained over years of being in the church. But not one person mentioned that Jesus is quoting from Psalm 22. And the psalm starts, my God, why have you forsaken me? But as we read the entirety of the psalm, it ends with God ruling over the nations coming back to worship God. And it's actually a foreshadowing of Jesus' resurrection. And at the end of Matthew, he tells his disciples to go and make disciples of all nations. So it's this beautiful echo of Jesus being established as king and then sending his disciples to all the nations, just as the psalm promised. But not one person in that Sunday school class knew that was the quote, that was the reference. And so he was saying that if we don't understand our Old Testament, we don't understand Jesus. And so in light of my students asking me that and kind of thinking about that in the church, when they invited me to preach, I thought, well, maybe I'll look at some key passages in the Old Testament, and maybe we can find our way through the Old Testament. But then I realized to go through the entire Old Testament, you know, in four sermons is a little bit difficult. I tried to narrow down the important ones, and it was more than four. We'll just say that. So then I was thinking, well, what if we look at how the New Testament uses the Old Testament, and particularly how the New Testament writers reflect on Jesus in light of the Old Testament scriptures. And the best place to do that is Matthew, the Gospel of Matthew. Matthew spends so much time pointing to Jesus as the Jewish Messiah, pointing back to the Old Testament. And in the next, in these four sermons, I'm going to look at just chapters 1 and 2 of Matthew. And in those two chapters, five times he quotes from the Old Testament, just in two chapters. And it's entirely to point back to Jesus in light of the Old Testament. And so I'm hoping as we go through Matthew, we'll begin to see Jesus in light of the Old Testament, and that we'll learn things about who Jesus and who he is. And so to start, I'm going to read, it's Matthew chapter 1, verses 1 through 17. And we actually have the text up on the screen, and so I'll be reading from the NIV, and you can follow along if you'd like. So Matthew starts, "This is the genealogy of Jesus the Messiah, the son of David, the son of Abraham. Abraham was the father of Isaac, Isaac the father of Jacob, Jacob, the father of Judah and his brothers, Judah, the father of Perez and Zerah, whose mother was Tamar, Perez, the father of Hezron, Hezron, the father of Ram, Ram, the father of Amminadab, Amminadab, the father of Nahshon, Nahshon, the father of Salmon, Salmon, the father of Boaz, whose mother was Rahab, Boaz, the father of Obed, whose mother was Ruth, Obed, the father of Jesse, and Jesse, the father of King David. Now David was the father of Solomon, whose mother had been Uriah's wife. And Solomon was the father of Rehoboam, and Rehoboam the father of Abijah, and Abijah the father of Asa. And Asa the father of Jehoshaphat, and Jehoshaphat the father of Jerem, and Jerem the father of Uzziah. And Uzziah was the father of Jotham, Jotham the father of Ahaz, Ahaz the father of Hezekiah, Hezekiah the father of Manasseh, Manasseh the father of Ammon, Ammon the father of Josiah, and Josiah, the father of Jehoiakim, and his brothers at the time of exile in Babylon. After the exile, Jeconiah was the father of Shealtiel, Shealtiel, the father of Zerubbabel, Zerubbabel, the father of Abihud, Abihud, the father of Eliakim, Eliakim, the father of Azor, Azor, the father of Zadok, Zadok, the father of Akim, Akim, the father of Elihud, Elihud, the father of Eleazar, Eleazar, the father of Matan, Matan, the father of Jacob, and Jacob, the father of Joseph, the husband of Mary, and Mary was the mother of Jesus, who is called the Messiah. Thus there are 14 generations in all, from Abraham to David, 14 from David to the exile, and 14 from the exile to the Messiah. So the way I've structured my talk is around three questions. Three questions that will help us understand the text. And my first question is, why start with the genealogy? Which is probably what many of you are asking about me reading this all to you. Right? And the reality is, this is the portion of the Christmas sermon that gets skipped over because nobody wants to hear all the names. But I actually think that Matthew has a point, and so I didn't just read all the names just to bore you for a couple minutes. Got a few chuckles again. Slow day. That's okay. And I think the point of Matthew's genealogy can actually be seen in kind of a modern phenomenon, which is ancestry.com. So that's something people do today. Maybe some of you have even tried it. But for those of you who don't know, ancestry.com, you put in your name and your parents' name, and then it's an online database that draws sources for you to fill in your family tree. And so my grandpa has actually done it on my mom's side. He spent a good year, this was kind of his main hobby, filling out this massive family tree, and he got it all printed out, and then once he was done, he stuffed it under his bed, and it gets pulled out like once every like 5 years when he remembers it, you know. But you learn fascinating things about your family. So like my mom's maiden name is Coates, and at one point there was a Coatesville, Colorado, that was started by the Coates family, and now it no longer exists. So you learn fascinating things. Going farther back, you find where your family came to the United States often. So members of my family crossed over even the early 20s to come to the United States. And it means something for who you are today. It tells the story of your family, how you ended up here. And that's really significant. It's been really impactful for a lot of people. So much so they even had a TV show where celebrities kind of trace their ancestry and found out all sorts of things. It's a quite modern phenomenon, but I think it's also picks up why Matthew is using a genealogy here. It tells us something about Jesus, and it reflects back on the entire Old Testament. And the Old Testament makes up 75% of the Bible, which may surprise you, because I actually have a copy of the New Testament and the Old Testament. This is my Old Testament, and this is my New Testament translations that I use. And they appear roughly to be the same size, and yet this is 25% of the Bible, the New Testament, and this is 75% of the Bible, the Old Testament. And Matthew manages in 17 verses to remind us of the story of 75% of the Bible in order to tell us something about Jesus. And he structures it in three manners. He says there are 14 generations from Abraham to David, 14 from David to the exile, and 14 from the exile to the Messiah. So I just kind of want to talk about those periods and what they mean. And so the first one is Abraham to David. And so we first meet Abraham all the way back in Genesis chapter 12. So we're 12 chapters into the whole Bible when we meet Abraham. And before Abraham, we get all sorts of interesting stories about how broken humanity is, right? And so Genesis 1 starts with God creating things. Genesis 2, we have this picture of God creating humanity, right? And he says all sorts of things are good. Right, and then we turn the page, we're three chapters in, Genesis 3, everything goes terribly wrong. Right? Humanity rebels against God, sin enters the world, right? What is good is now broken. right? We're only three chapters in at that point, right? And then from chapters 3 through 11, we get all sorts of stories, right? There's murder, right? God gets so angry that he floods the entire earth and just leaves one family, right? The story of Noah and the ark. And yet we quickly find out that Noah's family isn't all good immediately after that, right? We get all sorts of weird stories. We get the Tower of Babel, where they try to go up to God in order to bring him down, right? This form of idolatry, right? So within just two chapters, all that's good is broken. And then we get to Abraham. And when we jump to Genesis 15 in particular, that we get this God promising to Abraham. And the promise is that his offspring, his family, will be a blessing to all the nations. And in light of all that's come before Abraham, we have to see this promise as a solution to the problem of sin and brokenness. Right? All the nations are now suffering from idolatry. Right? The story before, the Tower of Babel, right? They're all idolatrous. They don't know God. But through Abraham and his family, God is going to go about fixing that. So we continue reading along, and Abraham does have children, and some of his children are better than others. Some of them aren't exactly very good people. But eventually they end up in Egypt, right? And they have enough children that they actually become an entire people group, and they become enslaved in Egypt, right? And that's the start of the Exodus, or the book of Exodus, right? So we're one book through the Bible now. And we read these great stories about God remembering his promise to Abraham, right? And he sends plagues, and he brings the people out of Egypt through the prophet Moses, right? And it seems like the story is finally getting back on track, right? These are the people who are supposed to be the solution to sin and brokenness, and God is doing amazing things and freeing them from their slavery. Maybe the story is getting back on track, right? So much so, right, that God even has this massive tent built for himself, and he resides in the center of this tent, right? The very presence of God is with these people. And yet we continue reading about their idolatry, right? About how they complain against God, right? About how they have to wander in the wilderness for 40 years, they can't even enter the promised land. An entire generation has to die out before they can enter the promised land because of their sin, right? But these are supposed to be the people who are the solution to the problem, right? And so eventually they do enter the promised land, right? And things continue to go terribly wrong. And so they finally get around to a point where they cry for a king. Maybe a king will bring order. And that's where we get David. Right? And David is declared to be a man after God's own heart. Right? Maybe the story is getting back on track. Maybe David will do the great things. Maybe he'll lead Israel to be that blessing to the nations, to fix the brokenness that started in Genesis. Except we continue reading, right? And it turns out David isn't such a great guy. And we'll come back to that. His sin is mentioned in the genealogy itself. Right, and so that takes us through kind of this first segment, this first 14 generations from Abraham to David. And then we get from David to the exile to Babylon. And the story follows in the book of the Kings, right? First and Second Kings, and it talks about all these kings that come after David. We get Solomon, right, the wisest man in the world. And what he does is he builds a temple for God, right? And now God doesn't just have a really cool tent, he has a really cool house, like a permanent structure, a temple. And we read stories about God's presence filling the temple, and it shakes, and it's violent, and the priests can't even enter. And it seems, right, maybe the story is getting back on track, right? Maybe these people will actually be the solution to sin and brokenness that God has promised. And then we turn the page, right? And Solomon starts taking hundreds and maybe thousands of wives, right? And they start introducing idolatry into Israel. And the people become idolatrous. And we read how after king after king after king actually furthers the idolatry, except for like two of them. There are like maybe two good ones in the entire story, right? And it it even says that they're, what they do doesn't really matter because the kings that come after them kind of undo it all, right? So the people of Israel, it seems, are part of the problem, even though they're supposed to be part of the solution, right? So much so that God starts sending them the prophets, right? And the prophets say, look, if you don't stop sinning, God is going to send you into exile. He's going to have a nation literally come and conquer you. And as we get closer to that time, they start saying it's going to be the Babylonians, right? And we actually get Ezekiel's vision, right, of God's spirit leaving the temple as the Babylonian army comes into Jerusalem and destroys it and takes all the upper-class people into exile, it says, right, by fish hooks in their mouth. It's this violent image, right? And that takes us through this second 14 generations, from David to the exile to Babylon. And then we have this last section, 14 generations from the exile to the Messiah. And this is where things get really interesting, right? So this is where we get, you know, like the books of Ezra and Nehemiah, under the Persians take over the Babylonians, right? And we get the Persians kind of allowing the people to return, and they start rebuilding the temple, and it may be the story will get back on track. Right, but that's kind of where the Old Testament seems to end. And we actually have a 400-year gap between the end of our Old Testament and the beginning of our New Testament. And in that time, the Greeks come and take over the Persians, and the Greeks really try to destroy the Jewish way of life. So much so that the Jewish people revolt, and they actually throw off the Greeks. And you get the Maccabees or the Hasmonean Empire. And it seems, right, like in their mind, maybe the story is getting back on track, even though this isn't necessarily recorded in our Bibles, right? They finally have their own nation again. There's some hope, only to have the Romans come in, right? And the Romans come in and take over Israel. And that brings us into the first century, into the time of Jesus' birth, the last few years of the BC and into the AD, the first century. Right, and it seems this entire time, right, that we thought there was going to be a solution, right? We've wandered through thousands of years. We've wandered through wars and nations and stories of all these individuals, and the problem is still present, right? And so the people begin to look to when God will take them out of exile. And when God takes them out of exile, what that means is he'll forgive their sins and he'll get the story back on track. Then the people begin to look for a Messiah, one person who would kind of be the representative of God, who would be God in person to lead them out of exile and begin the story again. And so we've made it through the entirety of the Old Testament in summary, right? And I've told you now, right, if we don't understand our Old Testament, we don't understand Jesus, right? This is the backstory to who Jesus is. If we don't understand the promises to Abraham, if we don't understand that it's the problem is still present all the way from Genesis chapter 3, it still hasn't found its solution, and yet God has promised it's going to come through the people of Israel. If we don't understand these things, we don't understand Jesus. And so for us today, I think we have to remember, at any time we turn to the New Testament, we have to keep this story in the background. Any time we look at Jesus, we have to remember that it's thousands of years of story, of history, of expectations, of a problem and a promise to a solution to that problem, to the problem of sin, right? And that's why it's important that Jesus comes in the first century, that he's born in Israel, that he's a Jewish man, right? That he comes during the time of exile under Rome. So we have to keep these things in our mind so that we understand our Old Testament and we understand Jesus. So the second question I want to ask from our genealogy is there are five women who are mentioned in the story. And so what about these women? is the question, because that's not normal. The genealogies from the first century don't typically include women. So just a quick rundown, we get Tamar is the first one, and we meet Tamar back in Genesis, and she's actually the daughter-in-law of one of Abraham's descendants, a guy named Judah, and Judah refuses to give Tamar a husband after her husband dies, and so she kind of manipulates him into having a child with him. And then we get Rahab, right? And so she's a prostitute, but she acknowledges God, right, as the people of Israel are coming into the promised land and taking it over. And so she actually helps them. And so she's a foreigner who kind of joins the Israelites. We get Ruth, right? So Ruth has her own book of the Bible. And we read that she's a Moabite, and she gives her loyalty to her Jewish mother-in-law, and she's an example of a foreigner who's faithful to God. And we get Bathsheba, and she's mentioned in here as the wife of Uriah, and I kind of alluded to that earlier, right? So this is David, this is the king, right? And he lusts, essentially, after Bathsheba, and takes her, right? This is exploitive move of the king using his power. And then finally, right, in order to cover up his sin, right, he'll have Uriah killed, right? And then he tries to cover it up even more, right, until the prophet Nathan finally comes and says, God has seen what you've done. And so it's a story of intense brokenness, of someone who is supposed to be a man after God's own heart, and yet we have this great moral failure and great evil. We see the problem of sin even in this person who's supposed to be a man after God's own heart. And then the last woman we have is Mary, right? So we have a woman who's betrothed to Joseph, and we have the most modern equivalent, right? But they're not yet married. And it says she is the mother of Jesus, the Messiah. And so we have these women kind of put into the genealogy. And the question is, why are they there? And I think it shows two things. One, it demonstrates kind of the brokenness in the story, right? These women are either exploited by people in power, like Bathsheba, exploited by the king, or even Tamar, exploited by her father-in-law, Judah. And we see that these are the people who are supposed to be getting the story on track. These are the great figures in Israel's history, right? And yet we see their brokenness, right? And the scriptures don't shy away from their brokenness, right? It's not these people necessarily who are faithful. It's God who is faithful. And yet we also see these foreign women, people like Ruth, a Moabite, who are welcomed in to God's people. And it's this beautiful foreshadowing, right, of all of creation being renewed, right, of all the nations coming to know God, right, of Israel fulfilling that promise in a small, like, kind of one-off occurrence of all the nations being blessed by Abraham's family. And so for us today, right, when we read these stories in the Old Testament, many of my students tell me that these people are just supposed to be examples. They're supposed to be examples of faith, and then we get to Jesus, and then we finally understand that sin is defeated. But I actually think it invites us to a lot more. It invites us to see the story as it goes. It invites us to see the brokenness that started in Genesis 3 and continues on. It invites us to see that all of the nations, all of the people will come to know the true God. It invites us not necessarily to see these people as examples, but see that the problem is so pervasive, that sin is so pervasive, that it consumes even the people who are supposed to be the solution, and yet to look on God's faithfulness. And I also think it invites us to see ourselves as part of the story, right? If we who follow Jesus today are going to say that Jesus is the one who will bring this healing, who will be the solution to the problem that started in Genesis chapter 3, right, then we're also obligated to bring that to our world, to look out at the brokenness in our own world, in our own neighborhoods, in our own families, right, in our city, in our nation, and to say that Jesus is the solution there too. Right, so seeing this as part of the story, seeing Jesus as the relaunch of Israel's story, if you will, to be that solution, obligates us to action, obligates us as followers of Jesus to action. Right, we can't just leave Jesus here in our church, can't just leave Jesus in our Bible studies, in our prayer times, right, in our own home. Right, because Jesus is the solution to a problem that plagues the whole world. Jesus is a solution to sin that marred, right, the good creation. So to kind of wrap up, the last question I want to ask is what do we learn about Jesus, about the Messiah, from a genealogy, a long list of names? And we see that Jesus is actually the relaunching of the story that started all the way back with Abraham in Genesis 12. Right? And the point is to set the world right. The point is that God is fixing what is broken, that God is fixing sin and death, brokenness, evil. They won't stand. Right? We see that Jesus fulfills promises to Abraham and to David, and they're promises that God has kept, right? Even though it seemed like the story got stuck, that sin couldn't be defeated, right? That the people who are supposed to be the solution are actually just as much a part of the problem, right? We see that Jesus means the end of exile, right? Which is the forgiveness of sins, right? That the story will get back on track, right? That the Jewish people, Israel, will be the solution, right? This time it comes down to one Jewish person, Jesus, right? The Messiah, the Son of God, right? And he tells his 11 Jewish disciples at the end of Matthew, right? Because Judas is gone. We spent some time on Judas a few weeks ago. So Jesus is left with 11 instead of 12. But he tells them, right, to go and make disciples of all nations, right? It's picking up the story that got broken all the way back here at the beginning in Genesis. And we see that Jesus' backstory is filled with brokenness and redemption, with brokenness and unexpected loyalty to God. And yet it's also filled with a longing for God to act, a longing for God to fulfill these promises all the way back from Genesis 12, right, to be a blessing to all the nations, for the forgiveness of sins to come about, for sin and death to be defeated. So as I said at the beginning, if we don't know our Old Testament, we don't understand Jesus, right? And to look back on Matthew's genealogy is to remind ourselves of the whole story of the Old Testament. It's to remind ourselves of the whole story of 75% of our Bible, and it invites us to reflect on the brokenness, right? The brokenness in these stories, right? Also the brokenness of our own world. And it also sets the stage. It says, look, here is Jesus. Here is the Messiah, right? He is going to fulfill these promises that God promised thousands of years before, right? That the people of Israel would be a blessing to all the nations. And it comes down and it focuses in on this one person, on Jesus, the Son of God. And so over the next few weeks, we're going to continue to look at what it means that Jesus is the Messiah. And Matthew will continue to use the Old Testament to reflect on that, to point back to the story of Israel and say that God is fulfilling his promises through Jesus. Look forward to spending the next 3 weeks kind of going through Matthew, the rest of Matthew chapter 1 and 2, and looking at the Old Testament. But to conclude today, I just want to encourage us as we read our Bibles, as we read both the New Testament and the Old Testament, is to see the forest and not just get stuck in the trees, to see the big picture, to see the story. Because if we don't understand that story, we don't understand Jesus, right? And if we don't understand Jesus, that's a detriment to our faith and to the way we live out our faith. So let me just pray for us, and then we'll call it a day. Father, I thank you for our time together here. I thank you that you have promised a solution to the world's brokenness. And even as we see our world is still broken, that we know the solution and that we know that it is Jesus. And in light of that, God, I ask that you help us to live that out. Help us to bring Jesus to our broken world. And help us to understand who Jesus is in light of these, in light of the long story and in light of these promises. I pray these things in Jesus' name. Amen. Thank you. See you all next week.